there's always a message involved.
Good evening, Toronto. This is Radio Basics. We back for another week. I am your host for tonight, Steve DeSilva, and I'm here with my little brother comrade, Kabir Joshi Vijay. What's up, man?
Nothing much. How about you, Steve?
I'm good. I'm doing good tonight.
Good.
Happy thanks for giving me your land day, Toronto.
Yeah.
This is the holiday we know as Thanksgiving, the day when we apparently are supposed to celebrate this myth of peaceful colonization of North America. But when in reality we're forgetting the bloody colonization of this continent by imperialism, by colonialism. But nonetheless, give thanks for the food that we have, and give thanks that things could be worse, but things could definitely be better, which is why we struggle, which is why we're here. Good evening, Kabir. How are you, brother?
I'm good.
What do we got on the show tonight?
On the show today, people might have heard on the news this week about the supposedly, as the mainstream media would have us know, the first problem that students have been having with the police in their schools, which has been the arrest this week of a student at Northern Secondary School, mm-hmm. which is down by Mount Pleasant and Yonge.
That's right. We posted that to the Basics website if people want to see the YouTube clip mm-hmm. of that arrest.
So there's a lot of discussion in the media about it this week. We're going to get today the real story, actually. A couple of Basics and No Cops members went down to the school this past week, and Alok Premji from the Justice for Alwi Committee and the No Cops Coalition, the newly organized coalition against opposing police in schools, is going to be on today to give us the real story on what happened and what this tells us about police in schools.
We also have a special interview today, an exclusive interview done with an investigative journalist from Democracy Now, who's been holed up in the Brazilian embassy in the capital of Honduras, Tegucigalpa. He was interviewed by investigative journalist Christian Pena from here in Toronto. That it's an exclusive interview done with Andres. I forget his last name right now, but he's with Democracy Now, and he's talking about the repression that people are facing and the ongoing struggle of the masses in Honduras to overthrow the coup government of Roberto Micoletti. But other than that, we got a bunch of news that we're going to hit you up with. So in local labor news, in 2009, Toronto has earned itself the distinction of being a deeply anti-union city. And part of the country. In the midst of an economic crisis, with Canada passing its own banking bailouts, workers have been on the defensive as management uses the pretext of the crisis to wage an all-out war on the wages and benefits of workers. Toronto in 2009 has already been the site of two long, drawn-out strikes. First, there was the QP3903 strike here at York University, a more than three-month-long strike which straddled 2008 and 2009, as the York administration railroaded the union into a strike by offering nothing to the union but concessions. Then there was the city workers' strike of the summer of 2009, as the mayor, David Miller, and the city demanded of QP locals 416 and 79 major concessions as well. And now it's U of T students and Toronto Public Library workers who may be going into strike and are under attack. Last week, QP Local 4948, Toronto Public Library Workers Union, voted overwhelmingly in favor of going on strike, giving their bargaining committee a mandate of 86%. 86% of workers supported the bargaining committee if talks do not lead to an acceptable deal. The chair of the bargaining committee, Maureen O'Reilly, said, "We have been negotiating with the library since April and had not been able to come to a fair agreement. There has been a worrisome shift in the direction of local community-based library services at the Toronto Public Library in the past few years. More and more, the Toronto Public Library has been looking to corporate models of delivering public library services developed in the context of massive cuts to public libraries in the United States. This has had a very negative impact on the 2,400 predominantly female workers of the Toronto Public Library." This quote from Maureen O'Reilly. About 50% of the library workers, who number 2,400 in the city and are mostly women, once again, are part-timers and have fewer benefits than their full-time colleagues. Meanwhile, at the University of Toronto, Unit 3 of QP 3902, representing contract faculty, have given their own bargaining team a strike mandate of more than 70%. Our members have the worst job security at U of T, and in fact, across the Canadian university sector, said Dr. Leslie Germain, Unit 3 representative and chief spokesperson for the union's bargaining team. We must reapply for our jobs every 4 to 8 months with no guarantee of future employment and no notice of layoffs. And yet, the university relies on some of us for 10 years or more without offering us any security beyond a single academic term. The contract faculty perform approximately 30% of the teaching done at the university, and they have no job security. The union is now seeking extended employment commitments to those sessionals who have been promoted for excellent teaching and long service at the university. They are also seeking support for research and scholarly activity for sessionals who currently have none, and wage increases to keep up with comparable wage rates for contract faculty across the GTA. And now to international news. Kabir.
For sure. So this Friday, as I guess everyone heard and commented on, President Obama was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Obviously an absurd and, you know, abhorrent choice that was made, particularly in light of the actions President Obama has taken since he took office. You know, there's been a lot of discussion in the media, you know, radio talk show hosts, etc., you know, denouncing this, the award of this prize based on the fact that Obama has not done enough to deserve it. However, the point that really should be drawn is that, in fact, Obama has done a lot since he took office. And those actions themselves qualify him as, you know, a warmonger president, not someone who's deserving of a Nobel Peace Prize. This is someone who has started a new war in Pakistan, killed dozens, displaced, you know, millions of Pakistanis. Up the war in Afghanistan, someone who continues to threaten Iran with attack and invasion unless Iran, you know, complies with U.S. government demands and relinquishes its rights as a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. This is someone who has backed Israeli apartheid to the, you know, till the end, was continued to, you know, allow Israel to construct illegal settlements, was allowed Israel to continue to, you know, murder Palestinian demonstrators in the West Bank and Gaza on, you know, a regular basis. And who continues to push for negotiations and further relinquishing of sovereignty and basic human rights on the part of Palestinians.
This is also a president who has agreed to build 7 new military bases in Colombia to further menace and threaten the, you know, the freedom-loving peoples of Latin America who are fighting for genuine independence and freedom, threatening to destabilize the entire region into regional warfare.
Definitely. I mean, the last time I checked, Guantanamo is still open. The Iraq war continues.
Yep.
Never mind, that's, you know, right, the oppressive policies inside the U.S. You
the
know,
menacing and threats towards North Korea.
Yeah.
Right? Which, in my opinion, has a right to defend itself and to, you know, position itself against any possible attacks. So this is a president who was given the Nobel Peace Prize for what? For waging, you know, relentless war, continuing the legacy of the Bush administration.
Yeah, who's you know, just been a continuation of the Bush policy. You know, as if Obama would be any less deserving than his predecessor to deserve this. This should come as no surprise to anyone who has looked at the history of the World Peace Prize, when we have people like Henry Kissinger, the well-known genocidaire, the person who was responsible for the murder of millions of North Vietnamese. You know, Shimon Peres, Yitzhak Rabin, again, Israeli war criminals, F.W. de Klerk, the president of apartheid South Africa. All these people are, you know, winners of the previous winners of the Nobel Peace Prize. So really, it should come as no surprise to anyone that this award is a complete sham and, you know, better represents the person who has best, you know, served to disguise imperialism at the moment than the person who has contributed to any kind of world peace.
Mm-hmm.
In other world news, and in fact, relating to, you know, the kind of world and the kind of world order that continues with Obama as president, in Afghanistan, the elections that occurred, I think this was back in August.
Yes.
I've now been exposed by the very UN Council that was supposed to oversee them as being largely fraudulent. The head of the UN mission has now come out and admitted that the August national elections were marred by, quote, widespread fraud. Kai Eddy made the comments at a news conference in Kabul on Friday, and he went on to defend his role in the election's aftermath, rejecting accusations from a former deputy that he had helped to cover up the fraud. And in fact, this former deputy of the UN, who was fired for basically saying that the UN mission had served to cover up this fraud that, of course, benefited Karzai, went on to say that up to a third of the votes for Karzai were fraudulent. And this is a huge blow to the, you know, the claim that has been pronounced by Canadian and American officials, touting this Afghan vote, this one and the previous one, as proof that they have restored democracy in the country. Mm-hmm. We all know that, in fact, the real people that picked Karzai were these very officials, American, Canadian, European Union officials. He was handpicked as the person to head up this new occupation government in Afghanistan in Bonn, Germany, back in 2001 before the invasion took place. So this is a selected president. This is a selected leader from the pockets of the imperialists. And, this election has now come out to have been fraudulent. In addition, Ethiopia or Somalia, another place that has seen the so-called peace acts of Obama, which have included invasion, occupation, violence, and oppression from a new UN mission, which has been responsible for the murder of many civilians in the past. Ethiopian troops this week invaded Somalia once again. Several hundred Ethiopian troops crossed over the border this weekend into Somalia, arresting dozens of villagers and bringing them back to Ethiopia. The alleged raid would come months after Ethiopian forces supposedly ended a two-year occupation that began with a U.S.-backed offensive. And in more international news, we turn to Steve with the downfall of the U.S. dollar.
That's right. The death of the U.S. dollar is on the horizon. The long-awaited movement by the world's largest economies to dump the weakening U.S. dollar is beginning to pick up its pace. Last week, Middle East correspondent Robert Fisk for the British newspaper The Independent broke the story that the Gulf states have been holding secret meetings with Russia, China, Japan, and France to replace the U.S. dollar with a basket of currencies in their trade of oil. The basket of currencies will include the currencies of Japan, China, the European Union, and a new planned unified currency being proposed for the Gulf states. Years ago, Iran began trading its own oil in non-dollar currencies, principally the euro, and Iraq under Saddam Hussein, just before the invasion by the United States, had also begun trading in euros. The reduced dependence on the world for U.S. dollars will reduce the capacity of the United States to run its increasingly massive budget deficits at the expense of the rest of the world, which hit $1.4 trillion in the last fiscal year, 2009. It's widely believed that the decline of the dollar will deal a blow to the American empire from which it will not be able to recover without stepping up its violent occupations and wars against so many regions of the world. However, the U.S. responds to the inevitability of the death of its dollar, other imperialist powers, but more importantly, the masses of people around the world and other anti-imperialist governments have begun to assert their independence in a way that the U.S. can no longer easily discipline. Kabir, do we have any other international news?
Nope, that's it. I think we can go to commercials and come back with Alok from the Coalition Opposed to Police in Schools.
Radio Basics, CHRY 105.5, we'll be back.
Your community radio,
CHRY
105.5.
Radio Basics, we back, and we got Alok Premji from the newly organized Coalition Against Police in Schools on the line with us today, who will be interviewed by Kabir.
How are you doing, Alok?
Good evening. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Great. So on Friday, or actually two Fridays ago, as many people in the city would have heard, at Northern Secondary School, one of the biggest schools in the city, there was an incident captured on video and posted on YouTube of the school resource officer at that school, Ali Musvi, arresting a student, and subsequently the student was suspended from the school and has been charged with assaulting a police officer. This comes a month after the school resource officer program, which started last year, has been expanded to now include in total 50 schools within the TDSB, primarily schools within so-called priority neighborhoods, neighborhoods that are primarily racialized and made up of low-income student body. The newly organized, I guess it's called now the Neighborhood Organizing Coalition Opposed to Police in Schools, has been opposing this program since it came into effect, and last year and this year as well has documented numerous incidents of police brutality and police misbehavior within these schools. We now have Alok on the line. Alok, members of No Cops were at Northern Secondary School last week and spoke to students about this event. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the overall sentiments from the students were that they did not want the police officer in the school. They believe that police shouldn't be in schools in the first place because along our line at No Cops is that police are not trained to be in an academic environment, to be in a scholarly environment where they are relating to youth. There is already an antagonistic relationship between the police and the youth mm-hmm. outside of these schools. So,
An antagonistic relationship, which I mean, I think that we can assume is not the fact that, you know, students are out there harassing or assaulting police. It's the other way around.
It is the other way around. I mean, getting questioned, just being interrogated for what's in your pocket, what's your name, when you're just walking down the street. The particular bodies, not everybody, but particular bodies because of baggy clothing or skin color or the neighborhood they're in, that's harassment.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of these youth who go to Northern experience policing in a different manner as opposed to other students from more affluent neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
But that does, you know, that's besides the point. The fact is that the youth out there did not believe that the police officers should be in schools, and this was only proved by the incident between Constable Ali Moosby and the student at Northern.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, when this was reported throughout the news media, this was being portrayed as basically the first incident or the first problem, the major problem with the SRL program. You know, as if this has been the first case of police, to put it, you know, lightly and liberally, misbehavior in schools. Is that the case?
Oh, no. From our investigation in the last 1 year, we've encountered many incidents where police have misbehaved, assaulted teenagers, strip searched for and found nothing, brutalized women and young men, and the police. These incidents have been videotaped. However, they didn't get that exposure that the incident at Northern received. Thus, you know, there was not much publicity around the issues. So the TDSB trustees were not aware of these incidents until No Cops had brought it to them at the end of the 2009 school year. So mm-hmm. this being the first one, we had, and people like trustee Josh Matlow, who was the one who was quoted in various public media outlets.
Yeah. He's a trustee for the ward that includes Northern Secondary.
Yes. He was saying that this is an isolated incident, and he knows very well that it's not an isolated incident that we brought to his attention mm-hmm. in that June meeting of the various other incidents that have occurred. He has completely taken the side of the police officer and discredited the entire story, because we spoke to youth who were there even before the videotaping was had occurred. And the story, although, you know, the kid had said some words to the police officer provoked the youth. And, you know, the fact that in the video it shows that the kid's asking why he's being arrested, and the officer's not, you know, giving him a reason,
mm-hmm.
Shows you that the police officers don't know how to interact with students. It's, they're playing the role of an enforcer. a law enforcement officer as opposed to a school or special resource officer they're supposed to be.
I think just very briefly for people that didn't see the video, just to briefly resume what happened. I mean, and we don't want to just go, we don't want to just focus on the details of the event. Hopefully we can have, you know, some students involved in that event that were actually there on later on, on a future show.
Because we don't have the consent from these youth to go out in public and share these stories, so it would only be appropriate for those students in particular to tell what happened, or unless they give us permission.
But I mean, I think that one thing that we can say is that, you know, the student is now being charged with assaulting this officer. The student didn't, not at any time, lay a hand on the officer.
No, not at all.
This student, in the video, the so-called minor injury that the officer suffered was a muscle strain from, I guess, you know, arresting this student. The student at no time, you know, and in fact, the student was the one that was assaulted.
Yeah.
By the officer and by other officers that were later called to the school.
Yeah, in the principal's office.
In the principal's office. And I think, you know, despite the fact that, you know, we can say whether or not the student was justified in calling the officer bacon or asking him if he liked bacon, the point is that the end result of the action of a student asking a police officer, do you like bacon, was that the student was assaulted, the student was arrested, and now the student is being suspended, possibly expelled from the school, and charged with assaulting a police officer. And that in any other circumstance, if the student had insulted a teacher, a student had insulted a fellow student, a student had assaulted another school official, I can't think of any other, you know, individual in a school where the outcome would be the same, other than a police officer.
Yeah, well, the outcome wouldn't result in the youth being taken away in handcuffs.
Mm-hmm. Sir, we only have 1 minute left, Alok, but if I can just ask, the No Cops has been doing its work for a year now. What is the sense amongst the actual student population around police and police in schools? Do they want them there or not?
Unanimously, they don't want them there.
Okay.
All right. And that was, we had the petition going on in Northern, and in a total of, 2.5 hours, we received over 500 or 600 signatures, and that's not even close to half the population of the school.
That was even out there.
All right, that was even out there. There was a big football game, and it was difficult because of school security, who were not allowing us on the premises to reach those students. But we're going to be out at Northern again this Thursday, at lunchtime and after school. We have the petition circulating around inside and outside the school. And you know what? If Josh Matlow, this petition, obviously, I don't know how far these trustees are going to take it, but the fact is that if Josh Matlow is not going to respect the opinion of the students, what rights do the students have? You know? Mm-hmm. And they feel that their opinion and rights need to be mattered.
And that goes the same for the community that we're broadcasting out of right here, right now, Jane and Finch, where the parents and the students have been very much opposed to police in schools, and they demonstrated to that effect.
That opposition, and despite that, police were put in all Jane and Finch schools this year, not only all the high schools, but I've been given access to the elementary and middle schools as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, Alok Premji from the No Cops Coalition, man, thank you very much for being online. We're happy to have you once again, and we'll have yourself or some other members of the coalition again on very soon.
We need to, I'm sure in the next few weeks we'll have actual students from Northern who were there present at the during the incident, and hopefully the victim itself air and get the other side of the story, which has not been depicted at all and has been muted in the public media,
no doubt,
and that's done purposely.
Well, let's keep in touch, brother.
That's why there's Radio Basics.
That's right, brother. Thanks a lot.
Right, thanks, Alok.
That was Alok Premji from the No Cops Coalition. We're going to be moving on to the next segment of our show, a feature interview on Honduras with an investigative journalist. The interview was conducted live from the Brazilian embassy, where the overthrown, democratically elected president, Manuel Zelaya, has been holed up for a couple weeks now. But before that, let's play a track. This is by the local Latino hip-hop group, Cold Blue. The song is by its member Most, who is a Salvadorian hip-hop artist. The song is called 12 Years. It's off their last mixtape. This is 12 Years by Most from Cold Blue.
around five volcanoes. Let me tell you who I am. It's gonna take a couple verses to explain it. It's an ugly picture back home, but I'ma try to paint it. Check it, we've been dirt corrupted politicians, making bad decisions, selling out our people till our country crumbles. And the poor keep taking it cause they so humble. And they got me feeling like let's get ready to rumble. Like every I put it on and took mad hits. Real gangster for the motherfuckers with a death list. In the war we learned hate, but at least the people late. Had to do something, we were losing numbers at a fast rate. And when we least expected, everything got mad hectic. No one was protected, ain't forgiveness for what they did. They pulled the plug on the archbishop. The death squads entered the picture, so they got richer. Dog, they got the people shook, everybody feared it. The best men, the most rebellious, were slowly disappearing. Intimidation tactics had you pissing out your urine. Torture methods made you talk. The pain that you're in made you wanna die and not endure it. Violence ran deep amongst my people, we couldn't cure it. Our children saw the bloodshed, treated like animals. Salvadorans fighting each other, turning to cannibals. The outcome of a war ain't pretty, it's understandable. The struggle was so real, you could feel it, it was tangible. Many fled home to leave illegal in Los Angeles. There we weren't welcome, motherfuckers couldn't handle us. Tormented by oppression, we decided to get scandalous. Crazier than angel dust, this about the point when the water boils. They get gone whole, wicked and their hearts boil. Salvadorans form gangs and we're expected to be loyal. Once again the war is on, more of us under the soil. I wish I could erase the suffering and turmoil. Just like Iraq being invaded over oil. They conquered all my people cause they know the blood is royal. 12 years, my people survive your worst fears. 12 years of oppression, dead wants and tears. Blood spilled, women, men and kids killed. That's fitted in the rhymes, the truth will be revealed. 12 years, my people survive your worst fears. 12 years of oppression, dead wants and tears. Blood spilled, women, men and kids killed. That's fitted in the rhymes, the truth must be revealed.
Radio Basics.
Apologies, a little technical difficulties. Radio Basics, we back. That was Most from Cold Blue. That was a song, 12 Years. And that track is about another civil war in Central America, El Salvador to be precise. That was Most of Salvadoran origin speaking about, singing about the situation that has plagued his nation for quite some time. Except now the revolutionaries are now in a position of... not to say complete supremacy in the government, but they were recently elected the
at least a strong position.
They're in a stronger position, and they definitely the revolution is on the move. We now move to an exclusive interview with Democracy Now! Reporter Andres Contreras, who was interviewed live from the Brazilian embassy in the capital of Honduras, the site where the democratically elected Honduran president Manuel Zelaya has been holed up since his secret return to the country on September 22nd, 2009. Zelaya was abducted from his home on June 28, 2009 by the Honduran military and sent to exile in Costa Rica. Zelaya was kidnapped and exiled the day that a vote was set to take place that may have saw the passage of constitutional changes that would have benefited the people of Honduras, such as the implementation of minimum wage reforms. Meanwhile, Minister of State of Foreign Affairs for the Americas, Peter Kent, Canadian Minister of State of Foreign Affairs, Peter Kent made a statement last week as part of the OAS, Organization of the American States, delegation visiting Tegucigalpa, the capital of Honduras, from October 7th to 9th. Kent called for a peaceful resolution to the crisis. A completely empty statement considering the violence that's being applied by the coup regime to repress the mass movement. Despite the halting of funds and cutting of ties to the Honduran government by most countries around the world, Canada continues to aid the de facto coup government, despite the fact that it is a military dictatorship at this point. We thank the Toronto-based interviewer, Christian Pena, an associate with the independent magazine Dominion, that people can look up online. We thank Christian Pena for procuring the interview, and also we thank the Toronto-based Latino organization, Barrio Nuevo, for bringing the interview to our attention. Now, here is Christian Pena interviewing Andres Contreras at the Brazilian embassy in Tegucigalpa, Honduras, on October 4th, 2009, the 99th day of resistance against the illegitimate Micheletti government.
Where are you right now in the building?
In the embassy.
You're in an office. Okay. Can you tell me what's going on today?
We had a mass with Father Andres Tamayo. at which the First Lady and President Zelaya attended. There's great expectation this week for the arrival of 10 foreign ministers related to the Organization of American States, who will come along with the Secretary General, Mr. D'Souza. And they're coming here to verify that the dialogue moves forward for a resolution to this crisis.
What can I ask you how long you've been in Honduras right now?
Well, the day of the coup itself, I was in my home in California, north of San Francisco, and I decided that I had to come here. So I was on a plane the next day on the 29th of June and have been in Honduras mostly since that time, leading delegations. We had an emergency delegation immediately that came as an international group in solidarity with what was happening and to monitor the repression by the coup regime. And then in terms of being here at the embassy, I came here on Monday, the 21st of September, which is the day that President Zelaya arrived here, and there were tens of thousands of people in the streets. And I was one of them, and then I was able to get into the embassy as press, along with some of my press colleagues. And they ended up leaving, but I decided to stay since Democracy Now! Wanted to have an interview with President Zelaya the next morning. That being the case, because at 5:30 in the morning is when they completely brutally removed over 500 people from in front of the embassy. So I've been here ever since. So this is, I believe, day 13, and actually it's day 14. Tomorrow will be the 2-week anniversary. It's 2 weeks since we've been here. So, and I would like to share that there is an initiative that was put forward by the Resistance Front. And it's called the Worldwide Fast for Honduras, People's Nonviolent Insurrection. And the insurrection call comes from Article 3 of the Constitution, but they are very much specifying that it's a nonviolent insurrection. And the fasting has been taking place off and on in many parts of the planet. We have a record of 25 countries that have been participating in some way. This coming, the 5th, which is tomorrow, Monday the 5th of October, will be the 100th day of resistance to the coup. And that is a day of fasting for Honduras worldwide. And then the next day, we'll begin a group will begin a water-only fast, both inside the embassy and elsewhere in Honduras. So invite people to visit the website called fastforhonduras.net.
Do you know, the date that I have is that the OAS members will be there October 7th. Do you know if that's confirmed, and do you know who the members are, or the same members that came during the first trip in August?
There will be more than those who came in the first trip, because there are 10. And I have not seen a recent list of those who will come. But I suspect all of the other, I think there were 7 last time, I believe all of them will come, and some additional ones.
What about the crackdown on protesters? I read also that people are protesting still passively and peacefully, or trying to at least, in front of the embassy to show support. Have you heard anything about that? Are they continuing? You know, is there anyone on the streets trying to protest, or people trying to show their support for the president since he's returned to the embassy in Honduras?
Absolutely, completely. This is day number 98, and on every single day since the coup itself, there have been manifestations, protests, marches. Yesterday there was a whole gathering of folks from the Resistencia, they call them, you know, from the resistance. They gathered to engage in cultural expression. In the previous couple of days, there were marches around the Radio Globo protesting the closure of that radio station. So every single day since the coup itself on June 28th, there have been protests in the streets. When I was out there, I would go to many of them, and they have not stopped in spite of the state of speech and in spite of the cancellation of constitutional guarantees.
One more thing about communications. Radio Global and all communications have been shut down. TV stations that are supporters of the, or are really not supporters of the coup, but essentially against the coup, that is still in effect. There is no communication coming outside. Obviously, you guys aren't transmitting anything. That is completely under control of the government and the military, that decree?
Yeah, the decree is still in effect, and Mr. Roberto Micheletti keeps saying that he will lift the decree. Apparently, it is a condition by which the 10 foreign ministers and Mr. Insulza, they are demanding that happen, or they will not come. Yes, Radio Global was closed, as was Channel 36. However, Radio Global was able to get back on the Internet, even though it cannot air on the airwaves.
That's right.
And so, one report said that the listenership had quadrupled as a result of the censorship. So, Radio Global is getting out there to the world, but most Hondurans do not have access to the internet, so they are not hearing the news that they need to.
Mm-hmm. Do you? I think we talked about this. I'm not sure what news you received. There was a Friday meeting between Roberto Micheletti and Jose Insulza, north of Tegucigalpa. I guess I'm not sure if there was any press that were present, but it was a meeting about 40 miles away. I'm not sure if there's any information from that. There was brief reports online about that.
Oh yes. Well, we had a tip that was happening at the time, and then 2 days later, yesterday and the day before, the press has been reporting that, and Mr. Micheletti admits that the meeting did take place at Palmarola between himself and Mr. Insulza. We don't know others who were there. We speculate that maybe Mr. Shannon came from the United States, or at least Hugo Lawrence, the ambassador here, the U.S. ambassador to Honduras, was probably there. We did not hear of others who were present. But yes, the meeting took place, and there have been some media stories about that.
One more quick question about the... let me just check here. There was a visit at the Brazilian embassy by representatives from Brazil that flew in. You were obviously in the embassy, so were you privy to that? Were you there when they arrived, and what were the meetings and what was said?
Yeah, I was here when they arrived. I was not in the meeting itself. However, we interviewed the members of Congress from Brazil after the meeting. And basically, they explained that they had meetings with the Supreme Court officials as well as with members of Congress, because they came as a legislative delegation to meet with other legislators. They did not meet directly at all with any Micheletti officials or coup regime folks. Their primary purpose was to ensure the integrity and the security of the diplomatic mission here, the embassy itself, and they were satisfied that is happening somewhat, though they were very alarmed about the heavy militarization. Both sides of the embassy are completely occupied by military and police. And blocks around here are totally, completely preventing anyone from approaching the embassy because of the hundreds of military and police who are around here. They were told about the violations of the Vienna Convention, which protects the inviolability of the embassy. That includes, soldiers who have climbed the wall between the embassy and the and they've been on top of the wall between the embassy and the adjoining properties. The tear gas assault on September 22nd, the assault with long-range audio weaponry that was used here against the embassy on the morning of September 22nd. And that is part of the directional energy weapons, include sonic weapons, and one of those was used against us. They also heard about attacks that in all probability involve microwave attacks against the embassy, primarily happening a week ago this past Friday. So the legislators from Brazil were given a full report about how the embassy has been attacked, both with psychological warfare as well as direct assault.
One thing I noticed and I read it, I wanted to confirm this, was La Primera Dama Xiomara Zelaya, that this is during the first, I guess, when the president returned and went to the embassy and took refuge there, that they were using gases and chemicals. I read that she scaled the walls herself. I'm not sure. Again, it wasn't clear, of the embassy, and she was sprayed with something in her eyes. Do you remember or recall any information about that? That she also had received contact with some of this chemical warfare?
You know, because there's so much uncertainty about the kind of high-tech warfare that's being done, the only thing that was imagined was that it could have been chemical. But since then, after some research and after some sources of information, basically it looks much more likely that it wasn't a chemical attack, but it was much more likely it could be a microwave weaponry attack. There's something we discovered called masers. It's not lasers that use light energy, but masers that use microwave energy. And this is a modern weaponry, and it's really absolutely condemnable that this has been used against personnel here who suffered from bleeding, coughing up bleeding, as well as nosebleeds. The president complained about serious pains and discomfort in his throat. But it's very directional, so not all of us in the embassy were affected. I did not feel anything, but others definitely felt the effects of that attack on that Friday morning, a week ago Friday.
And the sound waves, which I read as well, it was like, recently the G20 summit in the United States, they've used the same technology to use high decibel frequency technology to, I guess, disperse crowds. That was the first official time that was used. That was used in Honduras as well. You said you didn't encounter that yourself, but in the embassy, do you hear or do you feel nausea? Or do you feel sickness at times? Or do people in the embassy still at this point? Or is it only during that time?
With the sonic device, yes, of course, all of us were assaulted with that brutally that morning of September 22nd with that long-range audio device. And yes, you're right that it's the same one apparently used at the protest, the G20 protest in Pittsburgh. In terms of the effects of what probably is the microwave attack on the embassy a week ago Friday, the effects of that lasted most of the morning for most of those who were targeted, and it did not have any long-range impact that we can tell at this point.
I see. Well, one more thing before I let you go, because I'm sure you have work that you need to do. What is the, the plan for the next few? Is it everything is day by day there? Or you're preparing, obviously, and as well the president is preparing for these meetings when the OAS arrives. They are planning to meet with the president, and the president is planning to meet with Roberto Micheletti. That also is something I read, that those two were in plans for talks, but I'm not sure if they're actually going to sit down together and meet.
Well, the reason you're not sure is because I don't know if anybody is sure. I don't know there's a clear plan for that to take place yet. But what is certain is that there is a plan for these 10 foreign ministers to come, and they may, in fact, encourage the coup regime and Micheletti to meet directly with President Zelaya. What I have mostly been aware of is that members of the coup regime will be meeting with supporters of President Zelaya, those lower-level talks may, in fact, eventually lead to a direct meeting with President Zelaya and Mr. Micheletti.
That was Toronto-based investigative journalist Christian Pena interviewing Democracy Now! Journalist Andres Contreras, speaking live from the Brazilian embassy in Honduras before the Organization of the American States was planning to meet in Honduras last week. The OAS did indeed make its visit, and the foreign ministers left the country with no guarantees that democracy would be restored. Meanwhile, the coup government passed a decree over the weekend giving the authorities the right to revoke and cancel licenses of radio and television stations considered to be a threat to national security and accused of spreading hatred. Manuel Zelaya has indicated that if he is not reinstated by October 15th, he will not be able to recognize the election scheduled for the end of November in Honduras. Meanwhile, the people of Honduras continue to take their initiative in organizing to reverse the coup. If the coup is reversed in Honduras in the coming weeks or months, we need to recognize that it will certainly be the result of the popular uprisings of the people who have now been mobilizing for more than 100 days to bring something resembling a democratic order back to the country, and not the result of foreign ministers meetings. I think it's a bit of a joke, actually, that just to analyze how things have been unplaying in the Western Hemisphere over the last 6 months, even the last few years. I think countries like Canada and the United States are very scared right now of the potential for uprisings, for changes in government, and even for the potential for revolution in Latin America, which is why we talked about Obama building 7 new U.S. military bases in Colombia in the coming months and years.
As a way to keep these movements in check, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, so I find it really, it's a bit of an illusion that for these governments to be pretending like they're opposed to the Micheletti government. I mean, just in 2002, we saw how fast the Western governments recognized the kidnapping of Hugo Chavez and the institution of a new coup government. And now it seems like they're scared. And I think this is an important point to take note of, that they don't want to recognize coup governments. They are reconsidering their means of exercising their domination over Latin America. The fact that they're building military bases in Colombia shows that they are still concerned with the potential outbreak of revolution and the kicking out of imperialist influences in Latin America. But what's interesting to note is that they are scared to recognize this coup for the potential backlash that it could have in Latin America from people's movements like the one that's emerged in Honduras.
Mm-hmm. And that their response is, you know, on the one side, again, build up that military front to be able to outright brutally squash any kind of uprising that could occur, and then on the other hand, perhaps an attempt at co-opting or negotiating some kind of middle ground where the result is something that they feel less challenged or less
We have to remember too, the government of Manuel Zelaya, I mean,
he's not, exactly.
This is a liberal government.
Yeah.
This is somebody who is part of the Liberal Party, who is not revolutionary or even a leftist. You would be hard pressed to even consider him a leftist.
And I think the danger that is coming here is definitely not from Zelaya coming back in power. It's the movement
and the way
that they've been strengthened throughout this.
Absolutely.
Through this struggle. Steve, we're running out of time.
So let's go to commercial, and Radio Basics will be right back.
You're listening to CHRY 105.5 FM, your community radio.
Radio Basics, CHRY 105.5, we back, Stephen Kabir. So, moving on to the last segment of our show today, for the time that we do have left, is cultural news. And you know, when Basics or Radio Basics talks about culture, what we're really talking about is people's culture.
Culture,
people putting culture at the disposal of their struggles, their economic, political, and social struggles. So, last night, I saw Capitalism, A Love Story with my new wife. And so after 2 weeks of the box office, this new Michael Moore film is holding on to the 9th spot. His latest film takes us through the U.S. of A. in 2009. A country where, as many may know, vast regions and once great cities now look like post-apocalyptic, hollowed-out shells of their previous existence. What Moore does in the film is basically hold up a mirror to the absurd economic injustices in today's America. He takes us to meet airline pilots making $17,000 a year, working two jobs to get by while selling their own blood plasma just to survive. We meet America's largest corporations such as Walmart taking out insurance policies worth hundreds of thousands, if not millions, on their own employees, making them more profitable dead than alive. We meet judges getting millions of dollars in kickbacks from the prison industrial complex for sending hundreds of youth away to be incarcerated for the pettiest and silliest acts that could hardly be considered crimes or offenses. For example, there was one girl, I think, who was thrown into lockdown for a year for building a MySpace page that insulted her school principal. Or you have an evicted small farmer then getting paid $1,000 by the same bank that swindled him out of his house and home, getting paid to clean out and dump all of his furniture.
To burn his furniture.
And of course, the film takes us across all of these absurdities alongside the fabulous economic bailouts that are being given to banks such as Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan at the expense of regular working class people in America. Some have said that Michael Moore's film is just riding the wave of popular outrage against the economic bailouts to the rich over the last year. But Moore's film can really be thought of as a sequel, I think, to his debut film from two decades ago called Roger and Me, where Moore took us through his hometown, Flint, Michigan, which was devastated by the unnatural disaster of the deindustrialization of the manufacturing sector, particularly auto, in the United States. But amidst the disaster and the wholesale theft of public funds that Moore introduces us to in the film, which has him pulling the stunt of trying to make a citizen's arrest on the boards of banks, amidst all this, the only hope that the film inspires us with is that of American people, on the one hand, losing their faith in the American dream and starting to realize who the real enemies are. We see Chicago workers at a door and window factory taking direct action to extract from their employers the severance packages that they were owed. We see communities coming together to take direct action to halt the county sheriff from carrying out eviction orders. We see workers' co-ops providing direct evidence that factory workers are indeed capable of smashing the division of labor within the workplace between managers and workers and simply running and owning the whole enterprises themselves. All of these throughout the film signs that that suggest that the power really is with the people if they choose to unite and to exercise it.
But I think that becomes almost somewhat confused, even in like the strike scene when they show like Obama coming on TV and you know his support for the strikers somehow helped them to their victory, right?
It's definitely a confused film, which is the last point I'll make. You know, I think its analysis is pretty confused in the sense that it not only offers us not really much in terms of where to go. I mean, while Moore at one point in the film makes a critical observation that, for example, in the golden years of post-war American capitalism, that these glorious days of American capitalism were only possible because of the devastation of World War II. And because America helped oversee the smashing and the destruction of its main industrial rivals in the world, you know, Japan and Germany. And then at the same time, later in the film, Moore is alluding to the greatness of the 1930s, of Franklin Roosevelt, and to the post-war constitutions of Germany and Japan as examples that a capitalist society, you know, could be a pretty good place to live. So it's contradictory in the sense that he's glorifying, these certain periods of industrial America's history when, you know, you used to be able to get by in a single wage member of the family, people having starter homes, but yet at other points in the film showing how the American economy really is in a state of irreversible decay and its decadence is linked to that decay. So I don't know, I appreciated the fact that Moore was holding up a mirror to American society today, and I think those scenes really speak for themselves, but you know, I think Moore, the director, has done a better job than Moore, the narrator, in the film. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, we should probably wrap up, but you know, the other thing, I think the absence, this was a film, I think, primarily made for like middle class or supposedly middle class white America and Canada to that extent. Like, you know, I noticed the particular absence of any narrative on, like, for example, illegal immigration and the, you know, the vast sweatshops that line the American border with Mexico, right? You know, the absence of analysis on, like, gentrification when he was talking about foreclosures, the absence of analysis on the way that, you know, black and Latino families were primarily targeted. And despite that, you know, even the examples of capitalism that he mentioned, there are so many other more absurd, more abhorrent, more overt examples of capitalism's exploitation that, you know, that he could have expounded. But I think he chose ones that perhaps people could relate to more, that people could kind of, you know, that the average American supposedly could. I mean, even his film about healthcare was geared more towards, you know, the people that already have healthcare.
Yeah.
Rather than the people that don't. So, I mean, you take it for what it is. It's great in terms of, like, this is the most anti-capitalist, cultural film that will reach, you know, the top boards in.
That's right. It's at number nine right now.
Yeah.
You know, I agree.
That's important that he did that, and it's an important stepping stone that at least starting kind of mainstream discussion around these topics that will maybe get people past some of these conceptions of, you know, loaded words such as socialism, etc. We'll maybe get them past that. But again, no solution that's offered, and he does. There's a lot more to it than just that. Than that's just on the film, but it's definitely worth watching, and was definitely, you know, interesting to watch. Other than that, we should also announce that next week, next show is our fundraising week. CHRY, make sure to call in. That's it for Radio Basics this week. Kabir,
Steve,
signing off.
We'll see you next week, man. Yeah. A sound investment is starting on Wednesday, so listen and tune in. We need your funds to keep CHRY going. We are a community radio station, and
the only community real true community radio station left in the city.
Yeah. So keep tuned for Every Day I Have the Blues, the next show that will be on Radio Basics, CHRY 105.5. Yeah. We out.